This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. This week, we're going to be doing something new here on the podcast. It's a new series, sort of like a feature, I guess, that I want to do from time to time. I'm calling it Rock 101, and it's where I look at an artist from the past that, for whatever reason, I feel like is underappreciated, that I want to talk about in a modern context and provide a gateway for people to get into that artist, you know, even if there's not a timely hook to it. You know, the only timely hook, I guess, is that you want to hear great music that you haven't heard before. So that's going to be the idea of this new feature we're doing here called Rock 101. And the first artist that we're going to be talking about for this feature is someone who I think is one of the great singer-songwriters of all time. You know, someone that doesn't come up enough when we talk about Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, all of those people, because I feel like this person definitely belongs in that conversation. He's not as prolific as those artists. He's not as successful. He's not as famous as them. But if you look at the body of work that he put together and the songs that he wrote in his time, I think that it stacks up to almost anyone in rock history. And the person I'm talking about is Townes Van Zandt, a quintessential Texas troubadour, a guy who put out his first record in the late 60s and put out six albums, really, from 1968 to 1972. And then he had this long career after that where he really was the guy that, when you think about the romantic loner on a stage with a guitar, you know, the sad sack person playing song after song about romantic desolation and fatalism and the idea that we're all ultimately alone in the universe. The person you're thinking about is Townes Van Zandt, whether you know it or not, because that is the guy who fits that archetype more completely than anyone else and has probably influenced a lot of the people that you love that have emulated that, you know, whether they're in alt country or in indie rock or wherever the case may be. And I would venture to say that as good as a lot of the people are that followed in his footsteps, there is no one that has surpassed him, even now. Townes Van Zandt died in 1997. So it's been a while, you know, since he's been making music, and yet his legend continues to loom large. You'll occasionally hear his songs in movies now, like if you watch Hell or High Water or Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. His music is in those movies, and it's usually used to evoke this sort of Southwestern noir type feeling, you know, a desolation that exists in the wide expanse of America. There's something about Townes Van Zandt's music that evokes that very strongly. But, you know, I'm blathering on and on about this guy. I'm telling you about how great he is, but I'm not really giving you any entry points. Like, if you've never heard of Townes Van Zandt, how do you get into him? And why should you care? Well, I thought that the perfect person to talk to about this it would be Tyler Mahan Coe. Now, hopefully you know who Tyler is already, because he is the host of a podcast called Cocaine and Rhinestones, which I think is the best long-form music podcast in the game right now. If you haven't listened to it, what Tyler does is he will take an artist from country music history, and it may be someone who is older, like Merle Haggard, or it might be someone who is a little bit more contemporary, like Winona, and he will do a deep dive into that person's career, not only exploring the history of that person's music, but breaking down the songs and telling you what it is about them that makes them work, what makes them tick. He's a really smart, insightful person. And when I was in Nashville last month, I happened to be there because I was working on a project. And Tyler lives in Nashville, and I just thought that'd be a great opportunity to hang out with Tyler for a bit. We hung out for an hour, and we talked about Townes Van Zandt and, you know, went over his career. And it just tried to sum up exactly what it is about this person that makes him so important and unique and his music so powerful. So it was a really fun conversation. Hopefully, if you're already a fan of his, you'll get something out of this episode. But if you never listened to him, I think this will be a great introduction to his music. And once you start listening to him, your mind will be blown. So that makes me excited. But before we get to that, we have an exciting thing that is happening with the podcast now. We talked about this last week, but we need to remind people again, Derek, of this exciting development. So what's going on? We're being offered with, like, robots can play our music, our podcast now or something?
Yes, when the robots take over, you'll still be able to listen to Celebration Rock, because we are now available on your favorite smart speaker device. If you have an Alexa, you can listen to Celebration Rock. If you have a Google Home, you can listen to Celebration Rock. And if you want to do that for Alexa, you just say, Alexa, enable Celebration Rock skill one time. That's all you have to do is say it one time. And from then on, it'll be able to play it for you whenever you say, Alexa, play Celebration Rock. Now, if you have Google Home, you just need to say, okay, Google, talk to Celebration Rock, or okay, Google, speak to Celebration Rock, and your smart speaker will play that for you right there in your home anytime you want, which is pretty cool. I actually now, when I go to friends' houses and they have an Alexa, I'll just do it over at their house so that they are getting the podcast when they least expect it. I think it's great. And of course, I want to remind you, we're part of the Westwood One podcast network. You can get us on the Westwood One app. You can get us on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review and anywhere else you really like to get your podcast.
Pretty much all the good podcast platforms you can get us, and all the bad ones, we don't even want to be on them.
That's right.
So all the good ones, you can find our podcast. I also want to give a shout out to everyone who has bought or read my book, Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. It came out last month. It's been out, I guess, now almost 5 weeks. But the response to the book has been really great. You know, the reviews have been really great. The emails I've gotten, the tweets I've gotten from readers have been really nice. One thing I hear a lot is, this book sounds like something I could have written, which I think is a compliment when people say that. I think what they mean is that it resonates with them. So thank you so much for everyone who's read the book. If you have not read the book yet, or if you are looking for a gift for Father's Day, it is still on sale. That's the great thing about books. Once they're on sale forever. I'm just throwing that out there. I mean, the book talks about dad rock, but of course, you know, the book is also talking about Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, all of those people. So check out the book, Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. And thanks again for everyone who's already read the book. I really appreciate it. Okay, guys, so me and Tyler Mahan Co., we got into it, talking about Townes Van Zandt. It was a really great conversation. So let's get into it. Here is me and Tyler digging into the great career of Townes Van Zandt. Okay, so I'm excited to talk to you about Townes Van Zandt, but before we get into that, I wanted to check in on season two of Cocaine and Rhinestones, or if there is going to be a season two. I know you do another podcast called Your Favorite Band Sucks, which is much different. So you're busy with that, but are you plotting a second season? Like, what's the status of that?
Oh, yeah, I'm working on it already. I was making both podcasts at the same time the whole time I was making the first one, so it's like the other podcast really isn't. So it's honestly sort of therapeutic to have Your Favorite Band Sucks, because with Cocaine and Rhinestones, I take it so seriously,
right?
You know, because it matters so much that I get everything exactly right. You know, it's history, it's information, you know.
When you were saying, like, I think one episode you said you spent like 100 hours on every episode.
Probably about 100 hours on every episode.
Which is just insane to me. I spend maybe an hour and 5 minutes on every episode of my podcast, so.
Yeah.
I salute you for that.
So just to be able to get together once a week and sit down with a friend of mine and just talk the worst shit on every band you can think of is, it really is just sort of like a decompression thing for me. So it's really nice. But yeah, I'm working on the second season. There's a lot of stuff that has come up around it, like business sort of things, that a lot of conversations that I'm having to have. So I'm not getting it done as fast as I would like, but it is coming along nicely.
Are you getting to the point where you can do this as your job?
Yeah, this is all I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Okay,
yeah.
Because I know, like, you were talking about, like, the Patreon page, mm-hmm. and, like, how, and just reminding people that, like, hey, this content doesn't just appear out of nowhere. If you like it and you want it to be around, you should support it, which is, especially with your podcast, like, because as you said, so much research, it's so dense, there's a lot of information in every episode. And I think it's good to remind people that you know, you gotta support these things.
It would take me 3 to 5 years to make a season of this podcast if I had a job. I quit working and lived off credit cards to make the first season. Definitely not recommending that to anyone else. But the Patreon thing has worked out, and like I said, there's a lot of other stuff that's happening. I mean, this is shaping up to be my life's work, I think. So yeah, that's pretty incredible.
And are you still doing the Patreon thing then? Are you getting like a sponsor? Like, should people look that up if they want to support the podcast?
Yeah, I am interested in working with sponsors. I've had a few potentially really good ones reach out to me already. I'm definitely not gonna be, you know, reading like the same exact ads that are on every podcast that everyone listens to, you know. I want to...
No Blue Apron ads?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm trying to set myself apart from most other podcasts, and I think that I'm bringing a lot of people to the medium. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people who are listening to this who've never listened to a podcast before, and I think there is no reason to treat them like everyone who has already been listening to podcasts. It's not the same audience, you know? So I'm really looking for like unique ways to go about things like that. Yeah.
So if people want to support it, should they still check out the Patreon page?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, people are still signing up for that. It's still growing, you know? Okay. I mean, the Patreon itself is not making enough for me to be able to, you know, have that be the only source of monetization. So I'm hoping to sort of have a bunch of different things happening that will bring in enough money to keep doing it.
Okay, so I'm saying right now, kick Tyler some shekels here. If you, it's a great podcast, check it out, and then kick him some shekels here. He needs, so we can tell his great stories. And do you have any, you probably don't want to say what you're already thinking about for season two. Is there anything in particular that you would tease?
I have said publicly that people can expect to hear a lot of George Jones. Okay. So I think that's probably as much as I would feel comfortable saying about it.
I gotta say, one of my favorite episodes was the Winona episode. So like the 80s country era would be something, not that you probably have a million people saying do this, do that, but that would be my comment card.
That episode, I'm really glad that I did that. That's one that I think someone who is super familiar with country may look at the list of people discussed in the first season and see that as an outlier, you know, like, what's that doing there? And I've gotten a lot of emails from people who said they didn't think they were interested in her at all, you know, weren't even planning on listening to that episode, but they listened to the rest of the podcast and they were like, well, I like it, you know, so maybe this will be good, and press play on it, and it just blows their mind, you know, which is sort of what I wanted to do with it. But also, I just think she's great, you know, I think that music's great. There are a lot of people who hate that time period in country, the whole 80s, 90s pop country stuff, but I think that stuff's awesome.
So, yeah, and I think that's what was so great about it, that you could do all of these sort of iconic, you know, old school country people, and then also say, hey, wait a second, this is also part of the story, and maybe you think you don't care about it, but once I tell you about it, there's so many twists and turns to this story that you're not going to be able to stop it once you press play.
What's really funny is I just wanted to talk about one of her songs. You probably heard me say that in the liner notes of the episode, but I only wanted to do, because I do some episodes that are just on a song for people who haven't heard it, and that was going to be a song episode, and then I found out that there was no way to honestly have a conversation about that song without telling her entire life story, because the only way that song happened that way is because of how her life had been.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so let's segue to the Towns Van Zandt conversation. And, you know, what's great about your podcast is that you're so good at, you know, sort of deconstructing this music and pointing out you know, what makes something country and like where that came from and the development of that. And with Towns Van Zandt, I'm wondering, like, you listen to his records, and based on what I've read, like, especially his early records, you know, the production on the record, it's very sort of indicative of the time, a lot of orchestration. There's, like, some harpsichord on song, like Baroque touches on some of his records. And, you know, based on what I've read, I think when he was emerging, there was some confusion about, like,
who exactly should he be on a record? Should he be a folk singer? Should he be a country singer? Should he be sort of a singer-songwriter in the mode of what singer-songwriters were in the late 60s, early 70s? Like, for you, like, when you think about Townes Van Zandt, do you think of him as a country singer, or how do you classify him?
I definitely do not think of him as a country singer. That being said, I mean, I do a podcast about country music. I have every intention of getting to Townes Van Zandt someday, because he's so there, you know, he's so right there. He referred to himself as a folk singer, and that's how right. That's how I would refer to him were that not the case. You know, he just sounds like a folk singer to me. Also saturated in the blues tradition, you know, he worshipped Lightnin' Hopkins, you know, tracked him down, played guitar with him, things like that. And as far as the album, I get the feeling that the way I think about Townes Van Zandt's discography is different than a lot of Townes Van Zandt fans who are probably going to get mad about some things that I say. I like that first album.
I do too.
The first album is the only one that I can hear someone's point when they're saying that his albums were overproduced. People say his first like four albums were overproduced, and not in my opinion.
Right.
You know, in that first album, something we were talking about a little bit before recording this is that Townes put out a live album officially. There are several bootleg recordings, you know. You can hear a lot of different versions of these songs. He re-recorded some of the songs from that first album, which, by the way, he said that he loved that first album too, and he kept working with Cowboy Jack Clement. So, I mean, it's not like Cowboy Jack Clement was the only producer around. You know, he could have gone to someone else if he hated it. So I think he did feel, after hearing it, that some of the songs were not presented the way that he would want them to be presented. But for a specific example, I think the song I'll Be Here in the Morning, I think the version of I'll Be Here in the Morning that's on that first album is the definitive version of that song. I think his re-recording of it later, I don't like it as much, you know, and that's just my feelings about it, you know.
What about like Tecumseh Valley, because he did that on the first two records? I kind of like the Our Mother the Mountain version more, because like, I would say, like, I agree with you. I feel like Our Mother the Mountain, the second record, you think of a song like Kathleen, for instance, and I think the orchestration on that is just beautiful. I feel like it's a little more refined maybe on the second record, but I totally understand. I think people have this idea of Townes Van Zandt, the mythology of Townes Van Zandt, as the guy playing in a rundown bar with an acoustic guitar, you know, sort of the quintessential troubadour. So to reconcile that with maybe the production of those records is hard for some people, maybe.
Well, yeah, and this goes back to the folk singer thing, which that is a fan community, or, you know, culture, or however you want to describe it, that really gets hung up on the whole idea of whether or not someone's the real deal, you know, the real thing, you know, which is hilarious when you consider who the most successful folk singer on the planet is. But, yeah. So he never really had a lot of fans when these first albums were coming out, but the ones that he did have, he got performing live, probably just by himself with a guitar, you know? So, hey, I got an album coming out. And then it comes out, everyone's like, what the hell is this? Right. You know, we thought you were, you know, we thought you were the next, like, Hank Williams Sr. We thought you were the next Woody Guthrie, you know? What is this shit? You know? And, yeah, I would say that there was those feelings. I mean, you can find some very bad writing about this album. Just opinions that I would say are ignorant. But again, it goes back. This is what he wanted to do. You know, he wanted to do this. The same instruments that are used on that first album are still get used on his songs all, you know, all the way to the end. You know, the same exact instruments. It's just they're used in a different way. The production is just a little less grandiose, you know, and just a lot less drums. I think what it really comes down to, and a lot of the times, is just the drumming. Like, people hear the drumming and they're like, ah, this doesn't work for me. And that makes sense, because Townes very rarely used drums. You know, there is a certain sort of rhythm to everything he's doing that drumming makes it very martial, you know, it's very like structured and everything.
Right.
But I mean, again, like you said, it's the second album, it's there's still orchestration on there and instruments that you would not expect to find. It's just dialed down a little bit. I think that Our Mother the Mountain is the best Towns Van Zandt album.
Right.
That's probably the best one, you know, in my opinion.
Like, did you ever hear that story about him, like when Joe Eli picked him up hitchhiking?
Yeah.
And, like, he was, like, wandering through the desert, supposedly, and, like, Joe, it was, like, 1969 or something, and, like, he was wandering through the desert, and his backpack was just filled with copies of Our Mother the Mountain. And when Joe dropped him off, he gave him a copy, and he took it back and played it for Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and it, like, changed the way they wrote songs after that, which I want to believe that story happened. It's like an amazing story.
Oh, I believe that story.
I mean, it sounds like Paris, Texas, though. You know, like, it's like where Towns is almost like the Harry Dean Stanton character, just wandering. Yeah, I want to circle back to this country music question because I think you're right in terms of just looking at it from a pure musical perspective. But there is something about him, too, I guess, sort of like on a mythical level, where I feel like his influence on certainly like the old country wing of country music has been profound. Like, I feel like, again, that sort of lonesome troubadour.
Yeah.
You see so many singer-songwriters sort of emulating that. Not even so much the actual songs, but sort of like the mythos of that.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's proven so enduring?
Well, this is where the conversation could take a weird turn with me, because I almost never listen to Towns Van Zandt, because like I told you before, he scares the absolute shit out of me.
Yeah.
There are certain singers and songwriters whose careers have a body count on them, okay? So like Hank Williams, George Jones, there's no telling how many people have died trying to be Hank Williams and George Jones.
Right.
Towns Van Zandt's career has a body count. And if you look at a song like Nothing, which is, I would say that a song like that is basically the opposite of religion. It's the opposite of faith and hope,
right?
Because there's just a certainty there of the abyss.
Right.
You know, that song can put you in a hole that you may not come out of. You know, this is very dangerous music. I'm not joking. I'm
right.
So serious, you know.
But that's part of the seductive quality of it, too.
Yeah, it's... I think that people have this idea about it because of all of that. And the reality is so much more difficult than that. This is not a guy that you would probably want to have been, like, close to.
Right.
You know, this is not a person that you would have wanted to care very much about. You know, because that there would have been a lot of problems that came from that. And if you were, even if you were a fan of his when he was around, that there were difficult times there too. There are so many stories about just the worst shows you can imagine. But that just adds to this legend, you know, of everyone really builds it up into this huge thing, and if you can strip it back down to reality, it's rough, you know.
Yeah.
It's not great. and by the way, what I was saying, he was aware of this too. He was very aware of the image that people have about him and people like him. Back to the body count thing. Towns Van Zandt knew that Kurt Cobain was a fan of Towns's, and when Kurt Cobain killed himself, Towns was like thrown into a depression because he thought that his music may have had something to do with Kurt Cobain's frame of mind. You know, so like, he knew this about himself. You know, he would turn down opportunities to co-write with Bob Dylan. Not because he didn't want to write with Dylan, he was a huge fan of Dylan's, but because he saw how people thought and talked about Dylan. You know, he didn't want to do that. But it's just a catch-22 there, because people hear that and you go right towards it, you know, just right at it. And Yeah, there was something else that you had mentioned that I meant to respond to. I'm not sure I'm going to remember it, though.
Well, let's talk about, our personal connections to this music. I'm curious, when you first heard about Townes Van Zandt and when it connected with you. Was that a simultaneous thing? Because it wasn't for me. When I first heard his music, I forget what record it was. It might have been, late, great Townes Van Zandt. I could appreciate the songwriting, but it didn't really connect with me. It was, a little bit later. It was really, I think, seeing that documentary, the Margaret Brown documentary that came out in 2005, Be Here to Love Me, that it kind of opened a door for me. And I actually feel like that soundtrack is a good gateway for people if you're curious about him, because there's a mix of album cuts, alternate versions, live songs. It's a good mix of things, just because I think, again, for some people, I know for me, I accessed him through the live recordings first, and then I kind of fell in love. I fell in love with the songs, and then I fell in love with the records. It was sort of the opposite of maybe how it would normally go. But I was curious for you, what was your sort of entry point for him, and what made you connect with him?
Well, fortunately, the first thing I heard was Our Mother the Mountain, and it was just the work itself. He is as good as everyone pretends anyone else is, right? You know, and better, probably. I mean, he's just a phenomenal wordsmith and an incredible guitar player, too. That should be pointed out, yeah, for sure. He's was a fantastic guitarist. But what he could do with words is, and this also, I can see how and why they would have used all the production and the type of instrumentation that they did on that first album, because there is an antique quality to his approach to pretty much everything. Life too, by the way. I mean, at one point he was living in a house with no electricity just because, okay, you know, he used to go camp out in the woods for weeks at a time. You could convince me that he was a time traveler, you know. There's something very similar to, I mean, I never really got into Shakespeare, but that's a word that you might throw around to, of just this, a very romantic capital R approach to language. I mean, if anyone hasn't heard him, I would just press play on the song Why She's Acting This Way, the last song on Our Mother the Mountain. That's one of the most beautiful arrangements of words that I've ever heard, for sure. And it is crazy, by the way, to talk about a song like Nothing that I did earlier, that I mentioned earlier, how hopeless that is. And then this is also a guy who could write a song like To Live Is to Fly.
Right.
You know, it's not like this is just a one-dimensional bum you out artist. It's just, for me personally, that side of him affects me so. I've been worried about crying while recording this the entire day,
right.
And just because, this is, I don't ever talk about what my favorite music is, because I'm afraid I'm going to say something stupid, and because it usually is my favorite music because it terrifies me in some way. There's something that just scares the shit out of me about it. I mean, Kate Bush is another one, you know? Like, right. I'm never going to meet someone in a bar, bring up Kate Bush, and start talking about her, because that's insane to me. Just the thought of, desecrating the subject in casual conversation is so thoughtless.
Well, and, you mentioned him as a great writer and as a great guitar player. I would also add, as a great singer, I think he's an underrated singer. I think he's the kind of singer that can be deceptively one-dimensional, and I think it's true that he doesn't have a great range in terms of how many octaves he can hit or whatever, but when you talk about the emotional element of his records and what affects me, it's often the sound of his voice and the way that I think what you're talking about with the darkness, in his music, and the danger in his music, I think is just how he can express the feeling of pure loneliness, probably better than anyone. And he can do it in a way, in a song like Nothing, which is sort of straightforwardly bleak. But I think of a song like Don't Take It Too Bad, mm-hmm, which I think in a way it's sort of like, it's like saying to someone, don't feel bad that life is so terrible. You know, it's going to be okay. It's kind of like a pep talk.
Yeah.
From the there's sort of a cheerfulness to it, but it's still coming from this sad place. But that always really affects me. That kind of glimmer of hope in the darkness makes it even more affecting in a way.
Yeah, and then there's also the other side of that coin, though, is that if he writes a love song, it's generally from a place of, but it's probably going to get fucked up. You know, like, it's probably not going
to
work.
Well, what about his most famous love song, If I Needed You, which yeah. was, you know, and again, like, we talk about his connection to country music. It would be that, because that's, If I Needed You.
If. It's a big if.
But was that a number one hit for Emmylou Harris?
Number three.
Because that was sort of the peak of his notoriety, I guess, during his life when he wrote that, when that was a hit. And then, of course, Poncho and Lefty
yeah.
was a number one hit for Willie and Merle in the early 80s. That's a good point. It says, If I Needed You.
Yeah, but also, but back to what you're saying about him as a singer, something that is interesting to, I mean, objectively, not a great singer, you know, but also, personally, I like a lot of bad singers. You know, I find it interesting when someone has a non-traditionally wonderful voice. But what's interesting is if you go find a song on this, Mickey Newbury recorded this song called Mr. Can't You See that he wrote with Townes Van Zandt. Mickey Newbury is like a virtuoso singer. So it's kind of the closest you could get to hearing what Townes Van Zandt would sound like if he just had a killer voice, you know?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't work as good. I love Mickey Newbury for sure, but if you listen to that song and just imagine Townes doing it, which I don't think that he ever did record it, I'm pretty certain Townes would affect you more if you were listening to him do that song.
Well, I was thinking too, like, he does a cover of Racing in the Streets, which is on the Road Songs mm-hmm. record. And, you know, I love Bruce Springsteen. He's like one of my favorite artists. I love his version of it, but the Townes Van Zandt version, I think he like cuts out a verse of it. It's like he plays it just kind of straight through with like no pauses between the verses. And it's like the most beautiful version of that song. And I don't know what it is about it. You're right, he doesn't technically have a great voice, but there is always, in terms of expressing emotion and expressing vulnerability and like actually sounding like the guy in the song.
Yeah.
Like he sounds like the person that actually was racing in the streets when he sings that, maybe like when he's a little bit older and broken down and reflecting back on it. It just blows me away whenever I hear him sing that. You know, which is a song, again, like you associate it with another singer, so you have an idea of what that song is, and then he performs it and takes it in a totally different direction, and it works beautifully.
Yeah, his voice also changed a lot, you know, largely due to lifestyle decisions, probably. Yeah. But I think Townes' most underrated album is Flying Shoes, yeah. And you can hear his voice is already changing at that point. I don't remember exactly when that came out, like mid-70s. 78. That sounds right.
Because it was like a gap, because he puts out those first four records, which, you know, it's like, For the Sake of a Song, Our Mother the Mountain, the self-titled record, and late great Townes Van Zandt. And then I think there's a gap after that.
There's like a six-year gap, because of the whole,
there's like
Eggers not paying Jack Clement for the tapes and
yeah.
nothing really happened there. And then the label falls apart after that.
Well, yeah, that's like a kind of missing chapter in his career because he did make a record in Nashville, which yeah. would have maybe been his country record if it had come out at the time. And his manager didn't pay. It's like such a weird thing. You think this like monumental artist, and yet in his lifetime, it was like dealing with sort of shady people. He was like not treated as a major artist. He was just some guy. Although other artists respected him, but in terms of the industry, he wasn't really getting a push.
It's my understanding that the title of the late great Townes Van Zandt was sort of to try to make people think that he had died, because, you know, the whole like you're once you're dead, everyone likes you more, you know. Like, that's my understanding, is that Eggers was really trying to make a lot of people think that Townes had died so that people would, you know, rediscover him or whatever. Oh, it turns out he's still alive. it is. I don't know. I can't. I mean, as soon as I found out that Towns Van Zandt existed, you know, as soon as I listened to it, it mattered a lot to me. So it's just you've got to think that people just didn't hear it, you know. And he's one of these people who transcends any genre. By the way, I mean, if we want to talk about whether or not he's a folk singer or a country artist or whatever, it doesn't matter, because someone who likes hardcore punk is still going to listen to this dude's albums. Right. You know, there's genre doesn't even, this dude, I mean, it's almost more than music. It's almost something bigger than music that's happening here. You know, there's a lot of metaphysical stuff that is working around Towns Van Zandt for me. You know, I can say that, and I'm sure that a lot of people who really love him would say the same thing.
All right, we'll get back to our conversation here in a moment, but I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week's episode, and it is Mack Weldon. Now, Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. They will provide the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants, and more that you will ever wear. Now, I have actually worn Mack Weldon before, even before they were a sponsor. I've worn their t-shirts. I've worn their undergarments. It's very comfortable. It's affordable. It looks nice. You know, it's not that ratty, tidy-whitey stuff that will make your wife or girlfriend, you know, sort of cringe when she sees you. This is really cool, fashionable, comfortable, affordable stuff. And to entice you further into checking out Mack Weldon, we are offering a special deal for Celebration Rock listeners. For 20% off your first order, visit MackWeldon.com and enter the promo code Celebration at checkout. Again, that is MackWeldon.com, promo code Celebration. You will get 20% off your first order. Again, you're not only going to be comfortable in these clothes, you're going to look great for your wife or girlfriend or significant other, whoever you need to look good for in your undergarments. Mack Weldon will take care of you. So again, go to MackWeldon.com, enter in the promo code Celebration, and you will get 20% off your first order. Okay, let's get back to our conversation.
I feel like we have to mention too, though, that he also could be really funny, especially on his live records. Like the joke about someone stealing the car at the end of his car keys, mm-hmm. and then he just flies open and they stole my girl too.
Well, you've got to, you can't just dump boulder after boulder on everyone's heads. You know, you've got to relieve the pressure a little bit. And I think he was very aware of that. And he loved bad jokes, which is even better than if he was, if he was a great comedian or something. Like someone like Roger Miller, who was just like legit a great comedian, you know. But Towns specifically sought out terrible jokes to tell, and it made it so much funnier, you know. A natural wit too. I remember reading a concert review where a siren, like, some emergency vehicle was driving by in the middle of one of his songs, and he just paused and said good luck to whatever that siren was for,
right.
You know, and then went back to his song. But he, I mean, I don't know, it's just, he's such a transparent person, you know. I think that there's one song, I think it's called Standin', that's I'm probably just straight autobiography, you know, of just this character that was never going to exist within the confines of society. You know, like, you're never going to get this dude to pay a mortgage, you know,
right.
Like he could barely hold on to anything. You know, there's so many stories about him just gambling everything away and not caring, you know. It's, there's a lot going on around it, and it all just comes through. You know, I think it's all just very transparent with him.
You've talked about Our Mother the Mountain being like one of his great records, a good gateway record for people. Are there any other albums that stand out for you as being like head and shoulders above the rest?
Well, I do think that Flying Shoes is the most underrated one.
I love that record too.
Especially anyone who, you know, doesn't like the production, of course. He put out a great live double album, Live at the Old Quarter, which that's probably exactly what everyone who got mad about that first album was expecting to have in their hands, you know, because it's just, he did a string of dates, he recorded all the shows, and you get the him talking between songs, you get the jokes that are on there and everything, and it's, yeah, it's him.
Right, and the Old Quarter was this basically dive bar in Houston that he played a lot in the early 70s, and you listen to that record and you feel, it sounds like there's maybe 50 people there, like, or maybe 100 people.
I think literally 100. I think that's all it could hold. Yeah.
So it's like not, it's not like he's playing some big arena like most live records. It feel, you feel like you could hear beer glasses clinking in the background, like the air conditioning's not working, and he talks about that. So it's not just, I mean, the songs are amazing, and it's just, like you said, it's like the atmosphere of that record is very much, I think, evocative of like what people would associate with Townes Van Zandt. So yeah, I always, that's a record I recommend to people a lot if they want to get into him.
Yeah, I mean, again, though, I do think that Our Mother the Mountain is the best one. I mean, like, there are some songs that are on the live album, they're good. I listen to the live album and I enjoy it, but there are certain songs, like Why She's Acting This Way. I love that song so much, and if when I'm hearing it on the live one, it generally just makes me want to listen to the one with the full production, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And Flying Shoes. I'm trying to remember what's on that record, because I love that record too. I love the title track.
Loretta is a great song that's on there. I would have to look it up to figure it out. I have all this stuff on vinyl, so I'll generally just like put an album on and not really pay attention to which one it is.
Right, which one it is.
But I went back and looked at them before having this conversation, and no one ever talks about Flying Shoes that much, you know. I think, isn't Rex Blues on Flying Shoes?
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's a fantastic song.
I think that originally appeared on the Old Quarter record, and then he recorded it for Flying Shoes, which is like just a beautiful song about Rex Bell, who was like a guy in his, I think he owned the Old Quarter, but he was also a singer-songwriter himself. And it's just like this beautiful five-verse song, no chorus, tracing a person's life in the song, basically. A relatively straightforward narrative for one of his songs too. Like, it's a pretty straightforward story song. I mean, there's always like Pancho and Lefty is such a great storytelling song, probably his most famous song, but a great thing about that to me, that's almost like, it reminds me of like a 70s like anti-western, you know, like where you don't get it clear, you know, it has a downer ending, but there's like ambiguity to it. You can read into it, you know, it seems sort of metaphorical, but it also is straightforward enough that Willie and Merle could take it and make it a number one song.
Yeah. Pancho and Lefty is a really good example of one of Town's great talents, which is the simile. Like, he could use a simile like nobody's business. And the skin like iron, man, like that is something.
Breath like kerosene.
Yeah, you don't. And it. So many people, because he would tell you that he doesn't even know what that song's about, you know.
Yeah.
But there are so many people who relate to that because it adapts to whatever they have going on in their lives, you know. They feel it. Even though it's not really about anything, you know.
I mean, it seems like a song about loss, you know, like a friend that you had, or maybe a version of yourself that you remember from the past that maybe was a better version of yourself, a more pure version, or someone you loved, and now they're gone. I've always interpreted it to be about that. That's what it makes me think of when I listen to it.
I've had about five or six different things that I think it could be about. Throughout the years, it's one of those things where it changes with as your life changes. That song changes to continue to fit your life, you know, the way that you need it to. It's magic. It's
One song I love of his is Buckskin Stallion Blues, which was in Three Billboards.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie.
That song was in there. It's funny because Townes Van Zandt has had a bit of a renaissance. As far as being on soundtracks,
yeah
like he, you know, Dollar Bill Blues is in How or High Water over
I heard,
the credits.
I think I heard Lungs on True Detective.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was Lungs or not.
It seems like Townes Van Zandt has almost become like shorthand for like a Southern noir. Yeah.
Well, it's shorthand for I know what I'm talking about when the subject is music, you know?
But also, I mean, I think it is almost like if you want to evoke death, like people would play Johnny Cash songs like from the Rick Rubin years, like they'd play The Man That Comes Around or something. It almost seems like if you want to sort of evoke the expanse of like West Texas or something, like, and you're going to set like a thriller in that part of the country, you play a Townes Van Zandt song because it just, it's almost like playing CCR if you're going to have a Vietnam movie at this point.
It's funny that you said that you referenced Creedence, because the other one I thought of was his cover of Dead Flowers on the Big Lebowski.
Right. Which was like one of the early, I feel like, because that was still at a time when, I think even in the 90s, Townes Van Zandt was still relatively unknown.
He was, Poncho and Lefty did a lot for him. Yeah. You know, he got to start playing some bigger rooms, and definitely more people were into what he was doing. But he was always an artist's artist, you know, always a writer's writer, always a guitar player's guitar player. And that's sort of the nature of that whole thing, you know. Like, yeah. If you are truly great, then your entire career runs the risk of being an artist's artist.
Yeah. I just wonder, like, with him, if he had had better management, if that would have made a difference.
Or if he
hadn't been addicted to heroin. I mean, that, you know, he had a lot of personal issues that derailed him.
Here's something we haven't talked about that would be pretty useful information, I guess, for anyone who doesn't know anything about him, which is that this is a guy who, he went off to college and started exhibiting some pretty troubling patterns of behavior, binge drinking, you know, not really caring about anything, and ends up getting diagnosed as manic depressive, I think. And
he, like, jumped out of a window. Yeah, that's like a famous story.
For fun, I think he was just
to see what it would feel like to jump. I think he fell out of a 4-story window and fell on his back, supposedly, because he wanted to know what it felt like to.
Yeah, I wonder what it'd be like to fall. Oh, let's do it.
Yeah,
I think there's another story about where he was pledging at a fraternity or something, but probably just wanted to show up for drinks, and he shows up to this party without a shirt on, and I guess all the pledges are supposed to be wearing pins, like a lapel pin or something. Yeah. So he just grabs the pin and sticks it into his chest. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's a Townes Van Zandt story.
I remember that story.
But no, so he gets diagnosed manic depressive, and in those days, the brilliant minds of psychiatry, one of the forms of therapy that they had was this thing called insulin shock treatment, which people hear shock treatment and they automatically go towards ECT. They think that you're getting electrocuted through a helmet. But this is different. Insulin shock therapy is they fucking, you know, load you up with this shit and put you into a coma for like an hour and then like do that 30 times to you. And so after that, Pound says that he basically lost his long-term memory.
Right.
So he doesn't, we should also probably mention, I'm nearly certain this dude lied a lot, you know, right. And that's just the way that it is.
Right.
But, he says that he didn't remember his childhood, didn't really have any short-term memory, and this also, I mean, that fits the pattern of his life. You know, this is, you could see this being a contributing factor to someone deciding to live the troubadour lifestyle of just traveling from town to town, playing music for money, you get what you get, you drink with it, you do drugs with it, or whatever. It's because it's like it's like you're just a blank slate. Like you get wiped, you get wiped clean at the end of every day, you know, and I think that goes. I can't remember how we got here, but however we got here,
this is lack of success. I think there was a ruthlessness to him that I mean, there's so many stories like this in music history. There's so many of these cult heroes that like we all love now, and at the time they didn't have any success. Whether it's Big Star, Nick Drake. Goes all the way down the line, and there is that sort of common thread of like something in the artist not really wanting to commit to what it takes to be commercially successful. Where there's, and it seems like with Townes Van Zandt, on top of all of his personal issues, all the struggles that he had, was just this maybe contrarian nature or not wanting to conform to what was going on.
Well, yeah, and so that would specifically come into affecting the career because, I mean, even after he did start packing in venues, you know, smaller ones, but after Pancho and Lefty, he's got a following, you know, enough to make a living at doing this and everything. I mean, he could clear a room. He could clear a room in 15 minutes, you know. Well, this is an off night, and everyone leaves. There's one story about he had had a fight with his girlfriend that day or something, so he shows up to the venue, only plays blues covers. He's got fans that are requesting his material. He just only plays blues covers. And he's with a band, so at one point he just goes off into the corner of the stage and just the band is playing. And there was a period of time where he decided he was going to play fiddle, you know, and everyone makes fun of how bad he was at playing the fiddle.
Right.
And so he gets the fiddle out and he's messing with that and he can't get it to do what he wants it to do. So he just smashes this fiddle on stage. You know, I mean, it's pretty, I don't know that better management fixes that, you know.
I read this story too about him in the mid 70s where he was at some country music convention function and he was on stage with Guy Clark and Waylon Jennings and a couple other people and they were doing some big jam at the end of the night and he kept trying to stand on his head on stage and he kept falling over and after that even Guy Clark was like staying away from this guy, like, because, you know, it was just like, do you not want to have a career? Like, why are you fucking up like this in front of everybody?
Well, I mean this is something that I get into a little bit in the first season of Cocaine and Rhinestones when I'm talking about Bobby Gentry. She, for anyone who doesn't know, she is an artist who quote unquote disappeared. But it was very intentional on her part. She was done, you know. She didn't want anyone asking her questions anymore, you know. And I think that people, especially now when, you know, going viral is such a thing that everyone wants to do, you know, kids just want to go viral. They don't care how. They just want the retweets and the followers and everything. That's wanting to be famous is what that is. And it's so difficult for a generation of people consumed with that to understand why anyone would not want to get all the followers and all the retweets viral videos and everything. And fame sucks, man. If you've got a choice between being rich and famous, be rich every single time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And yeah, it's not cool. I mean, there's a Charlie Pride used to talk about. Charlie Pride helped out Gary Stewart a lot, and Gary is another figure like Towns who is one of the greats, you know, one of the all-time greats, and just never had the career that he could have had, and drug addiction was a huge part of it. Charlie tells a story about going to Gary and saying, man, Gary, you know, if you cleaned up your act, you could be, you know, a legend. And Gary's like, I don't want to be any bigger than I am. You know, I want to get fucked up. I want to get fucked up. I don't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely, and Towns like to get fucked up too, from what it sounds like. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about how great Towns Van Zandt is. You know, there's that famous quote from Steve Earle that I think Towns Van Zandt's the best songwriter ever, and I'll stand on Bob Dylan's coffee table in my dirty cowboy boots and say that.
I always liked Towns' response to it, which is that he's met Bob Dylan's bodyguards and Steve Earle's not getting anywhere near his coffee table.
Where do you put Towns Van Zandt in the pantheon, I guess, of singer-songwriters?
I don't rank anyone anymore. I mean, he's definitely, if you've got a Songwriters Hall of Fame and he's not in it, you might as well not have a Songwriters Hall of Fame, you know? Like I said, I mean, really, if you've tried Towns and you just don't get it and you didn't hit the song Why She's Acting This Way on your trip in, I mean, go check that song out. You know, look at it on paper even. Write it out yourself and try to imagine what it would feel like to have created it. And I've done this so many times. I've sat down and written that song on paper just to feel what it feels like to write it down. And it's thrilling. It is crazy how good it feels to write that down on paper. And it came from him. It came from this guy.
Right.
You know, yeah. His talent cannot be overstated. You can't heap more praise on Towns Van Zandt than he deserves. You know, it's impossible.
Yeah, and I think, again, you hear about these artists sometimes and you feel like, okay, I've heard so much about Townes Van Zandt. He can't possibly be as good as he can be. And sometimes you can almost overhype someone where yeah. it can keep them out. But I would really say that if the albums aren't doing it for you, to dig into the live record or even some of the bootlegs. Honestly, like my favorite Townes Van Zandt collection is this compilation. It's like 60 live songs from throughout his career, just from different bootlegs. And it's like multiple versions of different songs. And that was like a big thing for me as far as really falling in love with his music. Just as you say, the writing of it, the way that he could be so poetic and also plain spoken at the same time, like where it's not the sort of poeticism that calls attention to itself. It just is beautiful. It feels unadorned. You know, and he often talks about how he dreams songs, which has also been disputed. Like he said that he dreamt If I Needed You. And there's in that book, in the Robert Earl Hardy book, he disputes that. There's like different stories about him actually working on it for a couple years or crafting it or whatever. But I also think just the way he delivers the songs and his voice as a limited instrument, the amount of emotion and vulnerability that he can express when he sings these songs, I think is really unmatched. I mean, I think in terms of just the ability to express the sensation of being alone, I can't think of anyone who is better at that than Townes Van Zandt.
And not just alone in a human being sense, but like a universal consciousness level right, like of alone.
Right, you know? like there's no God.
Yeah, like there's nothing. Like the song Nothing. I mean, in that song, Sorrow and Solitude, you know, like he straight up says those are the only two words you even need to remember in your entire life because that's the only thing that matters.
Right.
You know, it's the only thing that's real. And it's just like, fuck, man. And you know that's not true on Tuesday, but sometimes on Wednesday it is. And if it's true on Wednesday and you hear that song on Wednesday, you're fucked. Like,
but I would say too though that it's not just purely like depressing music. It's the kind of music where if you are also feeling the same way, this guy makes you feel less alone. Or maybe you feel less alone in comparison to him. You're like, well, I'm not as down the road as this guy.
I mean, you said that it was unadorned and plain spoken. I think that's true. I think it really did just come to him this way. I think this is just who he is. You know, like you're very much just hearing him. And by the way, I do believe that he could have written songs and dreams. I've definitely dreamed songs before, for sure. But, if you get your mind, your daytime mind working in that mode, your nighttime mind will go there sometimes on its own. It's pretty natural. But I think this stuff just came out of him that way. You know, I don't think that he did need to work very long on songs. I can't remember what the song was. It might have been Marie. That he wrote it in the morning, played it for Guy Clark, and then went across the street to the show that he was playing and performed it on stage that night.
Yeah.
You know, that's not something that a lot of people can do. You know, it takes songwriters time to learn their own songs. You know, you write it and then you have to learn it and then you can go perform it.
Yeah.
But for him, it's like, it's really like it just arrived complete to his mind and all he had to do was perform it.
You know, I mentioned earlier about how Townes Van Zandt has become an archetype for a lot of singer-songwriters. I think because of his talent and the music he created, but also because of the mythos around him. He represents a very romantic archetype about the troubadour, and the stuff of the terrible things in his life now get romanticized now in death. You know, the loneliness, the bad behavior, all that stuff. But in terms of like the art, do you feel like that he has heirs in terms of like just artistic heirs? Do you feel there's people working in that tradition now that you could liken to what he's doing? I mean, I feel like there's people attempting to do that. I don't know. There aren't a lot of people that come to mind that I would put on his level or even compare to him necessarily. But I was wondering if you would.
I mean, probably. I'm the kind of person where, when it comes to music, I want to trace it back to the source, yeah. You know, and because I find that what is generally most exciting to me is the source, you know,
right.
Like if there's ever, when you're 16, 17, you like bands, then you find out what the favorite bands of that band is, you start listening to those and you're like, oh, this is clearly better, you know, and I mean, that's just been my experience. So were I ever to hear someone who even reminded me of Towns Van Zandt, I would just listen to Towns Van Zandt, you know?
Right.
But I don't know. It seems like it would be real obvious if someone was trying to I don't think that he was ever trying.
No.
You know? And I guess the truest way to do what you think Towns was doing would be to not have to try. Like you probably aren't going to end up sounding like Towns Van Zandt if that's what you're doing, because yeah. You're not him, you know?
I just remember talking to Todd Snyder about that once, about how he felt there were so many singer-songwriters that were just trying to do sort of like the miserable aspects of Towns Van Zandt.
It's like Bill Hicks with comedians.
Right, know? Exactly.
Every fucking local comedy scene has 20 guys who want to be Bill Hicks.
And you know? It's like, they're missing sort of the full spectrum of what he did, and also just kind of like what you were saying, like if you can do what he did, you aren't as affected, you know, like if you're affected, you're kind of missing the point. It's sort of, if you got to find your own voice, and he, like you said, it seems like he plugged into something very pure in himself, like a pure expression where he could just kind of, like, what's in my soul can get through my fingertips and onto the guitar and my words, and there's no barrier there between like what I'm trying to express and what I can actually accomplish.
There's also something very courageous about him. I hear a lot of courage when I listen to Towns Van Zandt, because it's not wallowing. It's standing up and saying this stuff.
Right.
You know, it's not laying down, you know, and letting the car run over you or whatever. It's standing up and saying, all right, hit me, motherfucker, you know.
but also, like, doing it in his, again, like, going back to his vocals, he can do it in a way where there's, like, almost like a calm, or maybe it's just an acceptance.
I hear acceptance, yeah. Yeah. I hear, yeah.
Like, there's not a lot of pathos in his voice, but at least demonstrative pathos. You can hear it, but it's so underplayed, and it makes it more powerful.
To me, hearing him, it always sounds like the thing that needed to be reckoned with in order for me to be able to say this has been reckoned with by me.
Yeah.
So now I can just tell you about it.
Right.
You know.
Or maybe it's like, I'm a dead man walking. Anyway, so, you know, it's like, what, it's okay. I've accepted my fate, and I'm going to tell you about it. Whatever happens after this will happen.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I hard agree, yeah.
But there's also a lot of beautiful songs. I also want to say that for people. I don't want to scare people away from Towns Van Zandt.
I do, for real. Like, if you are given to bouts of depression, you know, yeah. Ever have thoughts of self-harm, I don't know that you should be listening to this music. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
You know, for sure.
Yeah, well, feel good, and then put on a Towns Van Zandt record. Tyler, it's been a pleasure talking with you about this, man. I really appreciate you coming down and doing it all, talking yeah. about Towns. You kept it together.
We
both kept it together, so I think we get a medal for that. But hey, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it. Anytime.
All right, take care. All right, so that was me and Tyler talking about Towns Van Zandt. Hopefully, if you are a novice in the world of Towns Van Zandt, you will now have a lot of recommendations that you can check out, a lot of entry points into his catalog. And then you can write me and tell me about how you're crying all the time, because it's such heartbreaking music. But you will feel good in the long run, I guarantee it, if you get into Towns Van Zandt. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Celebration Rock. Got to give a shout out, as always, to Derek Madden, the man who puts it all together. And also a shout out to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening and, you know, saying nice things about us, spreading the word, spreading the Celebration Rock gospel, and
keeping us around. You know, if not for you, there would be no podcast. So thank you so much for your support. We will be back again next week with more Celebration Rock. We will talk to you then.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets Podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.